Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 13th, 2005. This session is Idols or God? The One Thing You Need to Know, a consideration of Toni Morrison's book, Song of Solomon, presented by Paul Olson in the Fireside Room. This is disc number OLP-2005-03. Let's listen in.
You have to say that because the recording of this is so in demand all across the country. I want to get a take. I'm going to start with with our look at idols, with one of Western literature's, I think, greatest poems ever. It's William Wordsworth's Lines Composed Above Tintern Abbey. If you read it in high school, a long time ago, they used to read this in high school, I think. But I'm just going to read parts of it. And I'm going to ask you to pay attention to these phrases. Dizzy raptures, thoughtless youth, abundant recompense, presence that disturbs, elevated thoughts, and something. And what this is about is, he's a nature lover, and he's returned to the River Wye in this little old abbey that's kind of torn down and just, some foundation left at Tintern, and thus the title, Tintern Abbey, huh? Isn't that clever?
Yeah.
And he comes back after a considerable absence, and he's an adult now, and he reminds himself in the poem of what it was like to be a kid there, and then what it's like to come back now after things have changed. And what I'm trying to set up is that in this normal human journey that we have, William Blake calls it the journey from innocence to experience and then maybe to higher innocence. But we all leave that innocent stage. It's a worthwhile paradigm to impose on Adam and Eve's story. They live in innocence and then are forced out into the wilderness to experience life. And I think to support that kind of paradigm imposed on the story, notice that it's God who puts up the cherubim and the flaming sword to stop Adam and Eve from going back into Eden, or going back into the stage of innocence. It's almost as if God doesn't want his people to be, or God's people to be, these innocent, robotic, behave-at-all-costs people. Well, interesting enough, maybe. So just watch this for this. I'm going to skip through it. It's a long poem, but I'm only going to read just several lines from each section. Five years have passed, five summers with a length of five long winters, and again I hear these waters rolling from their mountain springs with a soft inland murmur. Once again do I behold these steep and lofty cliffs. And then he talks a little bit about what he sees. He talks a lot, but I'm going to give you a little bit. Once again I see these hedgerows, hardly hedgerows, little lines of sportive wood run wild, these pastoral farms, green to the very door, and wreaths of smoke sent up in silence from among the trees. That's what he sees, and then he comments on that he hasn't forgotten what this meant to him. These beauteous forms, through a long absence, have not been to me as is a landscape to a blind man's eye. But oft in lonely rooms, I mean, he's left this, and you can imagine him, and this is written in the Industrial Revolution, in the city, and he's left this rural area, so I'll start again. These beauteous forms, though through a long absence, have not been to me as is a landscape to a blind man's eye. But oft in lonely rooms, amid the din of towns and cities, I have owed to them in hours of weariness sensations sweet, felt in the blood and felt along the heart and passing even into my purer mind. The memory, and that's part of this, of moving from these mountains and cliffs where he lived at one time, where he played at one time. How often, again I'm skipping through, how often has my spirit turned to thee? The picture of the mind revives again. I am changed, no doubt, from what I was when first I came among these hills, when like a roe, I bounded o'er the mountains by the sides of the deep rivers and the lonely streams, wherever nature led. I cannot paint what then I was. He's returned now. But he's painfully aware that he's changed. And he starts out with, that time has passed. That time has passed, and all its aching joys are now no more. But not for this faint I, nor mourn, nor murmur, other gifts have followed. For such loss, I would believe abundant recompense. For I have learned to look on nature not as in the hour of thoughtless youth, but hearing oftentimes the still sad music of humanity, I have felt a presence that disturbs me with the joy of elevated thoughts, a sense sublime of something far more deeply interfused, whose dwelling is the light of setting suns and the round ocean and the living air and the blue sky and in the mind of man, a motion and a spirit that impels all thinking things, all objects of all thought. The language here, the dizzy raptures of the child, the thoughtless youth, I don't look at it that way anymore, but I have had abundant recompense. I've had payment double over for in how I've changed. And then we have this, the presence that disturbs, elevated thoughts. Something is better. Those of you who have been coming to Holden for a long time, if you weren't a kid here, you watched kids be here, and you saw what they did. And maybe they spent their time in the pool hall. But then somehow the older people don't spend their time in the pool hall. They're going to be out hiking. There's something else. And you know what I mean. The worship services are different to a 6-year-old and a 10-year-old and a 14-year-old than they are to a 25-year-old or those of us who are 30 and older. Yeah. Well, then, for quite a while, he talks about he's returned this in reality in his life. He's returned to this scene with his sister, and his sister is also his best friend. And he ends the poem this way, really, I think, speaking to her. Wilt thou then forget that on the banks of this delightful stream we stood together, and that I, so long a worshiper of nature, hither came with far deeper zeal of holier love? That's what the Song of Solomon is kind of about. And It's a crummy word, and I if you could think of a better one for me, I'll take it. But I call it the stripping process. And if you want to get fancy with it, it's kind of an existential stripping. And if you want to make that an image, we all have roles to play in the clothes that we wear that's kind of our symbols of those roles that we play. What are we like when we strip those away? What's the teacher like when he takes off his tie? What's the woman like when she just says, I'm not going to carry a purse? What's the teacher like that walks into class with sandals, not this one, but back home? I don't do that. And we begin to strip away some of the things that define us. You know, I don't have my fraternity shirt anymore. I don't have my football team jersey anymore. This is just anybody I'm talking about. And as we strip away, we have to come down to the core of what we are. If I don't have this tie to define that I am the teacher and you are the student, well then what am I? And what kind of a relationship do we have? Toni Morrison addresses that and suggests, like Wordsworth does, that if we get rid of this, move past these dizzy raptures and these thoughtless youths, there is really something, that wonderful phrase from Wordsworth, of holier love. It's much more complex, and it is indeed abundant recompense. Well, Toni Morrison's like that with his, with maybe, for whatever it's worth to you, I won't even ask you if you've read this or not. There's one copy left in the bookstore. It is in the library here, and it's in libraries all over back home. I teach American literature at Augustana College in Rock Island, and Pilot Dead is the main character in this book, and she is my favorite character in all literature. If that's a selling point, that's what it's meant to be. I have this cup of coffee up here. I realized this sitting here is from Rabbi Marks. I've never drunk a cup of coffee in my life. I can't even stand the smell of it. Yeah, but my mother just disowned me. May she rest in peace. They disowned me because you got to drink coffee. Why? Well, you're Norwegian. Give me a better reason. Well, because. And I seen this here today. I was going to sit like this, kind of holding it, so I wouldn't have to feel guilty. And I coached back home too, and it's college kids, and a big thing in college culture is we drink beer, and I said, you guys, you don't want to drink beer. It's not going to make you a better runner. But I know the pressure. So when you go to a party, you just get a can of beer and walk around the same one all night long. Mm-hmm. And you need a beer? No, thanks. I go, okay. And that's what I'm doing with this coffee. So if you want to fill it up, no, thanks. I'm okay. And the fact the smell is a little bit too close for me. Okay. The story in this wonderful novel, there's a character named Macon who's married to Ruth. They have three kids, and we're just going to talk about one of them, this is Macon the second, who is Macon the third, but he's called Milkman. And then Macon has a sister who is called Pilot. She's the character that is my favorite in literature. Macon is a very successful businessman. These characters are all black, and this is in a black community, and Pilot has been gone for a long time and returns, and Pilot is very unconventional. She shaved her head, she wears boots and men's shoes and dirty skirts and doesn't work, has a house with no windows. She's just a really weird duck. And she is an embarrassment to this successful businessman. And one of the symbols in the book, that, without talking about it, but it's a wonderful symbol and you'll catch on to right away, is that he walks around with his keys for all the properties that he owns, and he just jingles those keys all the time because that's who he is. He's this property owner, and he's a big man, and he can go to the bank, you know, and not many black men can. He can go to the bank and get a loan anytime he wants to. And then Pilot comes around, and he's got to claim her as his sister. So he says to Milkman, stay away from her. She's not going to teach you anything in this world. That's worth knowing. Okay, so I'm going to read to you first what he thinks of Pilot. She's been gone for a long time. She comes back. I mean, it's been years. When they were little kids, they were good friends. And that's not really developed much in the book, except it's clear. but now she's come back. Why can't you dress like a woman? He was standing by the stove. What's that sailor's cap doing on your head? Don't you have stockings? What are you trying to make me look like in this town? He trembled at the thought of the white men in the bank, the men who helped him buy and mortgage houses, discovering that this raggedy bootlegger was his sister, that the property Negro who handled his business so well and who lived in the big house on Not Doctor Street had a sister who had a daughter but no husband, and that daughter had a daughter but no husband, a collection of lunatics who made wine and sang in the streets like common street women. You're just like a common street woman. Pilot had sat there listening to him, her wondering eyes resting on his face, and then she said, I've been worried sick about you too, Macon. Well, we meet Pilot in lots of different circumstances, and if we have time, I can read you a wonderful passage. I'll skip it now. The first description of her. The point of the session today is not to talk about Pilot. Milkman, who's been told to stay away from her, comes over to her house, and he brings along with him his friend, and his friend's name is Guitar. And they're talking. Milkman and Pilot are talking for a while, and I'll put this up here too, just so we have it. Pilot has a daughter, and her name is Reva. And she, and we don't know who had relations with her. We don't know who had relations with Pilot to create Reva. We don't know here, and the daughter here is Hagar. I should say, Pilot has no navel. And because she has no, it's fiction, folks. Because she has no navel, she's ostracized from community. And you'll hear a passage later. She's not only ostracized from community, she's ostracized from and prevented from having individual relationships, too. The night that she had sex with this guy, who we don't even know, he's not talked about at all, except in the morning he wakes up, sees her bare belly, and says, my God, what are you, some kind of mermaid? And he runs out. And never again, because she's a freak. Except it's a freakish thing that no one can see, and that's an interesting fictional device. But something that's not very important has caused the world to separate, to ostracize Pilot. Okay, well, so back to the conversation. Milkman is there, we're talking with Pilot and his friend, and Hagar walks in. Hagar! Pilate looked around the room. This here's your brother, Milkman, and this is his friend. What's your name again, pretty?
Guitar.
Guitar? You play any? That ain't her brother, Mama. I'm sorry, Reva is here too. And Reva's the one that then says, you with me?
Yeah.
Pilate has said, Hagar, meet your brother. Well, they aren't. Okay, so, that ain't her brother, Mama, they're cousins, the older woman spoke. Same thing. No, it ain't. Is it, baby? No, said Hagar. It's different. See there? It's different. Well, what is the difference, Reva? You know so much. Reva looked at the ceiling. A brother is a brother if you both got the same mother, or if you both... Pilate interrupted her. I mean, what's the difference in the way you act toward them? Don't you have to act the same way to both? That's not the point, Mama. You already like Pilate, don't you? Well, you mean more. Well, then Macon decides that his son is wasting a lot of time. He's grown up enough, and he's about 17 now. And he spent a little bit more time than Macon is happy with about Pilate. He says, you got to stay away from her, because she's wacko. And the part of the title I put up on the kiosk for this session was The One Thing You Need to Know. If you remember that on there, I don't know, but here it comes. He wants her to stay, Macon wants his son to stay away from her. I haven't changed my mind, Macon. I don't want you over there.
Why?
You still haven't said why. Just listen to what I say. That woman's no good. She's a snake and can charm you like a snake, but still a snake. You're talking about your own sister, the one you carried in your arms to the fields every morning. That was a long time ago. You seen her. What she looked like to you? Somebody nice? Somebody normal? Well, she... Or somebody cut your throat? She didn't look like that, Daddy. Well, she is like that. What'd she do? It ain't what she did, it's what she is. Well, what is she? A snake. I told you. Ever hear the story about the snake? The man who saw a little baby snake on the ground? Well, the man saw this baby snake bleeding and hurt, lying there in the dirt, and the man felt sorry for it and picked it up and put it in his basket and took it home. And he fed it and took care of it till it was big and strong. Fed it the same thing he ate. Then one day, the snake turned on him and bit him, stuck his poisoned tongue right in the man's heart. And while he was laying there dying, he turned to the snake and asked him, what'd you do that for? He said, didn't I take care of you? Didn't I save your life? The snake said, yes. Then what'd you do it for? What'd you kill me for? Know what that snake said? But you knew I was a snake, didn't you? Now, I mean for you to stay out of that wine house and as far away from Pilate as you can. The wine house, she serves wine. It's the first thing she does. Anybody comes in the house, she serves them wine. She doesn't care how old they are. She doesn't ask for IDs. That's what she does. Or she cooks them an egg. Milkman lowered his head. His father had explained nothing to him. The last paragraph here. Boy, you got better things to do with your time. Besides, it's time you started learning how to work. You start Monday. After school, come to my office, work a couple of hours there, and learn what's real. Pilate can't teach you a thing you can use in this world. Maybe the next, but not this one. Let me tell you right now, the one important thing you'll ever need to know. Own things. And let the things you own other things. And then you'll own yourself and other people too. And starting Monday, I'm going to teach you how. You like that guy? So Macon comes out with his own things. And that's his whole philosophy of life. But Macon isn't a very happy man. And one night, he follows... he's just headed for home, from work to home, and he stops. It's a wonderful scene. He stops to look in the window at Pilate's house. And he has to look at the door, he doesn't have any windows. He stands back there, and there's a window there. He just stands back, and he watches what's going on in there. And he said, it reads something like, normally I just go home, I talk to my son, and my son says, Dad, look at the bird tuck in your shirt. Mama, look what I found, set the table. And that's how they live in their family. And tonight he needed music. So that's the phrase, that he just looks through the window and watches Pilate. She sits in her singing, peeling an orange, and if it's time to eat, they eat, and if it isn't time, they don't. Well, he realizes he's not, as Macon does, he's not very happy. And Milkman does too, and it's a novel, so in the length and development of this novel, it's Milkman's journey away from a Macon philosophy that says, own things. He's going to strip himself of a whole set of values and take on the values of Pilate. whose values are a little bit crazy, and I'll show you what I mean. Pilate's daughter is a little bit like Pilate, and everything she gives away. She doesn't keep anything. And there's no stuff in their house. When they get a gallon of milk, they drink it till it's gone. And when it's peach season, they have peaches in the house, and they eat peaches till they're gone. And that's just how they live. Well, Reba has a boyfriend. And she has given him everything, herself, her possessions. It's kind of a strange little thing. She's very lucky in contests. And every contest she enters, she wins. So she'll go down to the bingo table, you know, and she'll come away with $50. She'll sign a lottery thing, and she wins everything. And she gives it all away, keeps nothing. Well, Reba's new man friend had asked her for a small loan, and she had told him she didn't have any money at all. The man, who had received two or three nice presents from her unasked, thought she was lying, and was trying to tell him to shove off. They were quarreling in the backyard. That is, the man was quarreling. Reba was crying and trying to convince him that what she had said was true. Milkman came in to see this now going on. Just after Milkman opened the door, Hagar came running from the bedroom where she'd been looking out the back window. I guess they got two windows. She screamed to Pilate, "Mama, he's hitting her! I saw him! With his fist, Mama!" Pilate looked up from a fourth grade geography book she was reading and closed it. She's always reading this geography book, and that becomes symbolic too. Where am I in this world? And it's not only where am I, you know, geographically, but spiritually as well. So she puts down her geography book, looked up from her fourth grade geography book she was reading and closed it. Slowly, it seemed to Milkman. She walked over to a shelf that hung over the dry sink, put the geography book on it, and removed a knife. Slowly, still, she walked out the front door. There was no back door. And as soon as she did, Milkman could hear Reba's screams and the man's curses. It didn't occur to him to stop Pilate. Her mouth was not moving and her earring flashed fire. But he did follow her, as did Hagar, around to the back of the house where, approaching the man from the back, she whipped her right arm around his neck and positioned the knife at the edge of his heart. She waited until the man felt the knife point before she jabbed it skillfully about a quarter of an inch through his shirt into the skin. Still holding his neck so he couldn't see but could feel the blood making his shirt sticky, she talked to him. "Now, I'm not going to kill you, honey. Don't you worry none. Just be still a minute. The heart's right here, but I'm not going to stick it in any deeper. Because if I stick it in any deeper, it'll go straight through your heart. So you have to be real still. You hear? You can't move an inch, because I might lose control. It's just a little hole now, honey. No more than a pin scratch. You might lose about 2 tablespoons of blood, but no more. And if you're real still, honey, I can get it back out without no mistake. But before I do that, I thought we'd have a little talk." The man closed his eyes. Sweat ran from his temples down the side of his face. A few neighbors who had heard Reba's screams had gathered in Pilate's backyard. They knew right away that the man was a newcomer to this city. Otherwise, he would have known a few things about Reba, one of which was that she gave away everything she had, and if there was a case quarter in that house, she'd have given it to him. And more important, he would have known not to fool with anything that belonged to Pilate, who never bothered anybody, was helpful to everybody, but who was also believed to have the power to step out of her skin, set a bush afire from 50 yards, and turn a man into a right rutabaga, all on account of the fact that she had no navel. So they didn't have much sympathy for him. They just craned their necks to hear better what Pilate was telling him. "You see, darling, that there is the only child I got, the first baby I ever had. And if you could turn around and see my face, which of course you can't, because you can't, because my hand might slip, you'd know she's also my last. Women are foolish, you know, and mamas are the most foolish of all. And you know how mamas are, don't you? You got a mama, don't you? Sure you have. So you know what I'm talking about. Mamas get hurt and nervous when somebody don't like their children. First real misery I ever had in my life is when I found out somebody, a little teeny tiny boy it was, didn't like my little girl. Made me so mad I didn't know what to do. We do the best we can, but we ain't got the strength you men got." "That's why it makes us so sad if a grown man starts beating up on one of us. You know what I mean? I'd hate to pull this knife out and have you try some other time to act mean to my little girl, because one thing I know for sure, whatever she done, she's been good to you. Still, I'd hate to push it in more and have your mama feel like I do now. I confess I don't know what to do. Maybe you can help me. Tell me, what should I do? The man struggled for breath. The pilot eased up on his throat, but not his heart.
Let me go,
he whispered.
Let me go. I won't never put a hand on her, I promise.
A real promise, sugar?
Yeah, I promise. You will never see me no more.
Reba sat on the ground, her arms around her knees, staring through her unswollen eye at the scene as though she were at a picture show. Her lip was split and her cheek was badly bruised, and though her skirt and hands were stained with her effort to stop the blood pouring from her nose, a little still trickled down. Pilot plucked the knife out of the man's shirt and took her arm away. He lurched a little, looked down at the blood on his clothes and up at Pilot, and licking his lips, backed all the way to the side of the house under Pilot's gaze. Her lips didn't start moving again until he was out of sight and running down the road. That's Pilot. Excuse me, my allergy must be jumping on me. Well, there's more. And what we're seeing, of course, is, I just circle her. Pilot is a very different character than Macon. And Ruth, I'm not going to explain the plot of this, but Ruth's father is a complicated character. He's not very well developed, but he's had a profound effect on Ruth, and Ruth is a very classy woman, the kind of woman that, of course, would marry a Macon. As it turns out, though, it was Macon who said, this is the only kind of woman I can marry, somebody who's the father or the daughter of a doctor, and there weren't any black doctors in town, so this is really a big deal. So Macon gets to marry Ruth, and as I've already said, they have Milkman. But Ruth and her father have, according to Macon, have this very strange relationship. And when her father got sick and died, Macon tells Milkman that she came into the bedroom and found Ruth in bed with her father kissing him, and he was already dead. And she said, and then he talked about, because her father was a doctor, he delivered all three kids of Macon's and Ruth's, and he thought that was inappropriate too. So there's obviously something really sick going on between, and that's the truth, quotes around that word now, that's the truth, the story that Macon tells Milkman about his mother. So it affects Milkman's relationship with her, and this woman is just too weird. And we also know that she's pretty weird because she nursed Milkman until he was over 10 years old. And as the literature, as the narration says, until his feet touched the floor. And she still nurses her son. So she's a weird woman. That's, in fact, how he gets his name, Milkman. Freddie the janitor comes running by one day, and he's just running by the house, and he sees in the window, and he steps back, and oh my gosh. And he sees this happening. And no one ever tells Macon this, but Milkman knows. And so it's an embarrassment to him, but they still call him Milkman. Okay, all that said, we've got this weird, strange woman, right? And part of what I was suggesting, and why this comes in with the Wordsworth poem, is that the first stage of life, or the first stage of truth, is something we sometimes have to strip away. And Milkman decides, finally, I'm going to see for myself just how weird my mother is. So he knows that she goes out about once a month and gets on a bus and goes somewhere, but Milkman has no idea where she goes, so he follows her. And it turns out she's going to a cemetery. And here is that wonderful scene. She walked into the cemetery, and then he waited for an hour before she came out. And it's night, he's just been standing there, and he scares her to death. Hello, Mama, he said. He tried to make his voice sound as coolly cruel as he felt, just as he tried to frighten her by stepping out suddenly from behind the tree. He succeeded. She stumbled in alarm and took a great gulp of air into her mouth. Macon, is that you? She called her son, Macon, not Macon. You're here. Oh, my goodness, I... She tried desperately to normalize the situation, smiling wanly and blinking her eyes, searching for words and manners and civilization. Milkman stopped her. You come to lay down on your father's grave? Is that what you've been doing all these years, spending a night every now and then with your father? Ruth's shoulders seemed to slump, but she said in a surprising, steady voice, let's walk toward the train stop. Neither said a word during the 45 minutes they waited in the little shelter for the train back to the city. The sun came up, and pointed out the names of young lovers painted on the wall. A few men were walking up the stairs to the platform. When the train backed in from its siding, they still had not spoken. 45 minutes of waiting plus the walk back. They don't even know what to say because this is so awkward. Only when the wheels were actually turning and the engine had cleared its throat did Ruth begin. And she began in the middle of a sentence, as though she had been thinking it all through since she and her son left the entrance to Fairfield Cemetery. And then she just begins. Because the fact is, Macon, I am a small woman. I don't mean little. I mean small. And I'm small because I was pressed small. I lived in a great big house that pressed me into a small package. I had no friends, only schoolmates who wanted to touch my dresses and my white silk stockings. But I didn't think I'd ever need a friend because I had Daddy. I was small, but he was big. The only person who ever really cared whether I lived or died was Daddy. Lots of people were interested in whether I lived or died, but he cared. He was not a good man, Macon. Certainly he was an arrogant man, and often a foolish and destructive one. But he cared whether, and he cared how, I lived. And there was and is no one else in the world who ever did. And for that, I would do anything. It is important for me to be in his presence, among his things, the things he used, had touched. Later, it was just important for me to know that he was in the world, and when he left it, I kept on reigniting that cared-for feeling that I got from him. I am not a strange woman. I am a small one. I don't know what all your father has told you about me down in that shop you all stay in, but I know, as well as I know my own name, that he told you only what was flattering to him. I know he never told you that he killed my father, and that he tried to kill you, and that's all true. He killed his father by taking away his medicine, and he tried to kill Macon. He forced his wife into a miscarriage because he didn't want this kid. And Pilate, that's a wonderful part of it. Pilate comes over and performs voodoo, and Macon stays away. And the rest is milkman gets born. Okay, another little plug for Pilate time. Macon took away his medicine, and I just didn't know it. And I wouldn't have been able to save you except for Pilate. Pilate was the one who brought you here in the first place.
Pilate?
Milkman was coming awake. He'd begun listening to his mother with a dulled ear of someone who was about to be conned and knew it. Yeah, Pilate. Old, crazy, sweet Pilate. Your father and I hadn't had physical relations since my father died. And when Lena and Corinthians, her other two kids, were just toddlers, we had a terrible quarrel. He threatened to kill me. I threatened to go to the police about what he had done to my father. We did neither. I guess my father's money was more important to him than the satisfaction of killing me. And I would have happily died, except for my babies. But he did move into another room, and that's the way things stayed until I couldn't stand it anymore. Until I thought I'd really die if I had to live that way, with nobody touching me, or even looking as though they'd like to touch me. That's when I started coming to Fairfield, to talk. To talk to somebody who wanted to listen and not to laugh at me. Somebody I could trust, somebody who trusted me. Somebody who was interested in me, for my own self. I didn't care if that somebody was under the ground. You know, I was 20 years old when your father stopped sleeping in the bed with me. That's hard, Macon. Very hard. By the time I was 30, I think I was just afraid I'd die that way. We all know that one of the therapies in nursing homes is to bring animals in so people can touch things. And I was just talking with Al Rayo, one of our in-resident spiritual director. He's a chaplain at a nursing home. And one of the things he does is just sit with people and hold their hand to be touched. My 130-pound Great Pyrenees was a registered dog to go do that in nursing homes and hospitals. And again, it's just to touch animals, and I'd take this big white dog in and walk up bed height, you know, slip her chin on the bed. But you get the point. And so we're finding out that this crazy woman, Ruth, isn't so crazy after all. My point isn't so much to develop what Ruth is, but to suggest, that Milkman has to leave this stage where he just was a thoughtless youth and just kind of came and ran and played and heard what he heard and believed. And now he's got a different story and a different look at his mother. But the story, we're almost done. Then Pilate came to town. She came into the city like she owned it. Pilate, Reba, and Reba's little baby, Hagar. Pilate came to see Macon right away. As soon as she saw me, she knew what my trouble was. And she asked me one day, "Do you want him?" "I want somebody," I told her. "He's as good as anybody," she said. "Besides, you'll get pregnant, and your baby ought to be his. He ought to have a son. Otherwise, this be the end of us."
Milkman leaned his head against the cold handbar that was attached to the seat in front of him. He held it there, letting its chill circle his head. Then he turned to his mother. Were you in the bed with your father when he was naked, when he was dead? Naked? No. But I did kneel there, in my slip, at his bedside, and kiss his beautiful fingers. They're the only part of him that wasn't... You nursed me. Yes. Until I was old. Too old. Ruth turned toward her son. She lifted her head and looked deep into his eyes. And I also prayed for you. Every single night and every single day. On my knees. Now you tell me, what harm did I do you on my knees? It's a whole new truth, isn't it? Well, Pilate, and then we're almost done. It's your turn to talk about Pilate and stripping and what other things we can do. Pilate has been ostracized by her brother, by everybody. They almost throw her in jail. And here's the important paragraph, and we're just about done. Finally, Pilate began to take offense. And I'm just going to underline this word here again. This is her stripping process. And you'll see it. And I think the word existential stripping works, not because it's a fancy word, but because this is her whole self going to strip back and say, without my tie, without all those things that define me, who am I? Finally, Pilate began to take offense. Although she was hampered by huge ignorances, but not in any way unintelligent, when she realized what her situation in the world was and would probably always be, she threw away every assumption she had learned and began at zero. First off, she cut her hair. That was one thing she didn't want to have to think about anymore. Then she tackled the problem of trying to decide how she wanted to live and what was valuable to her. When am I happy and when am I sad? And what is the difference? What do I need to know to stay alive? What's true in the world? Her mind traveled crooked streets and aimless goat paths, arriving sometimes at profundity, other times at the revelations of a three-year-old. Her alien's compassion for troubled people ripened her and kept her just barely within the boundaries of the elaborately socialized world of black people. And true to the palm oil that flowed in her veins, she never had a visitor to whom she did not offer food before one word of conversation, business or social, began. She gave up, apparently, all interest in table manners or hygiene, but acquired a deep concern for and about human relationships. And that's what Milkman learns from her in the rest of the book. We're only halfway through the novel at this point. And now he's going to follow her, and for it's a long story. He thinks she has gold, and he's going to search this, and his whole life is to get this gold that Pilate has had. Well, Pilate doesn't keep gold, but he thinks she does. And in the process of finding this gold, he finds out who he really is. And then I'll read the ending. I kind of apologize to read an ending, let you know what happens. On the other hand, I don't think it hurts. My personal opinion, and you can really disagree with me. The whole novel is such a great journey that knowing what's coming makes it even better. Because the journey is great. Well, at the end, Milkman does realize, this is who I am. I'm going to put this word, sorry. Existential stripping. And what it means is, Bible study this morning, right? I am. Well, Milkman and Pilate are together burying the bones of Pilate's father. She didn't know she'd had these bones, but she found them, and that's a wonderful part of the story. But at the end, she realized what she has, and they've never been buried, and that she has to do it. And now he, who has adopted and taken on her sense of values, is going to help her. But Guitar, who never leaves the gold realm and wants to be like Macon, thinks that they have gold in this bag, and he's going to get it from him because he wants this gold. So the only way to get it at this point, and get this, he's willing to kill his best friend for it. So he's standing over across the hill, and he reaches up with his gun, and he shoots Milkman, but he misses. And Milkman and Pilate are burying the bones. Should he put a rock or a cross on it? Pilate shook her head. She reached up and yanked her earring from her ear. Oh, I didn't even say that. She keeps she took an old snuff can and roped it up and put her name inside it, Pilate. because that's her father named her Pilate, which was awful, she thinks. She doesn't think everybody else did, because that's a Christ killer, right? Because he named her, but he couldn't read. He just pointed a finger in the Bible, and that's what he came up with. She kept it, because this was who she was, and it didn't matter, and that's part of the story. And it didn't matter the luggage and all the connotations that the word Pilate carried to her. No, we can get rid of all that stuff. And she did. She could anyway. Okay. So she reached up and yanked her earring from her ear, splitting the lobe. Then she made a little hole with her fingers and placed it in Sings, that's her mother's, snuff box with a single word Jake, that's her father, ever wrote. She stood up then, and it seemed to Milkman that he heard the shot after she fell. He missed Milkman and hit Pilate. He dropped to his knees and cradled her lolling head in the crook of his arm, barking at her, "You hurt? You hurt, Pilate?" She laughed softly, and he knew right away that she was reminded of the day he first met her, and had said the most stupid thing there was to say. I'll go back to that. When he first meets Pilate, she comes in and says, "Hi." She says, "Hi? What does hi mean? You say hi to pigs. You don't say hi to people. What's your name, guitar?" "Hi." Or the milkman. And that's the stupid thing he said. Okay. So he's reminded of that day. The twilight had thickened, and all around them it was getting dark. Milkman moved his hand over her chest and stomach, trying to find the place where she was hit. "Pilate, you okay?" He couldn't make out her eyes. His hand under her head was sweating like a fountain. "Pilate." She sighed. "Watch Reba for me." And then, "I wish I'd have known more people. I would have loved them all. If I'd have known more, I would have loved more." Well, that's the end of Pilate. That's not the end of the book, and we do have to read that. Milkman then stands up. Milkman, who, now we're talking about abundant recompense. And all of this physical, my word's going to be secular, but we can also say material. This material world of the childhood, it means nothing to him anymore. In fact, "You can't kill me because I am such a spiritual being." That is this elevated thought. There's something else about me that's bigger. And Milkman stands up. And I'll read the ending, I think, as it should be read. Now he knew why he loved her so much. Without ever leaving the ground, she could fly. "There must be another one like you," he whispered to her. "There's got to be at least one more woman like you." Even as he knelt over her, he knew there wouldn't be another mistake. That is, guitar's not going to miss this time. The minute he stood up, guitar would try to blow his head off. He stood up. "Guitar!" he shouted. "Tar, tar, tar," said the hills. "Over here, brother man, can you see me?" And he's, "Shoot!" he's right. Milkman cupped his mouth with one hand and waved the other over his head. "Here I am, am, said the rocks. "You want me, huh? You want my life, 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 life." Okay. real life is here. In something that's holier. So what we can talk about for a few minutes, and we can. What does Toni Morrison suggest that we idolize? I mean, it's for Macon, it's his keys. And they stop him from seeing the elevated thoughts and experiencing the presence that disturbs, and as words were said, the holier power. What do we have to strip away? In our churches, in our communities, at Holden. Mm-hmm. One thing is this little vest is way too long.
Material things.
It's in, to be concrete, it's our keys, and that's the symbol of your material thing, that's good. We have to, for sure, gang, go to John DeGraff's session about getting back your time, and you saw a little bit of it last night. Well, that's the Hunger movie. You didn't. It's really an insightful look at our culture, and what we've done to ourselves. Just one little example is that we work way more hours, and it's all graphed out. We are less healthy as a nation. We produce less as a nation, even though we work more. And he's got all kinds of data about that. Well, yes.
There's a rawness in living in that place, though, and it isn't It's countercultural, it's painful. And our culture, we aren't raised to know how to be comfortable in that skin. So from very young age, we start layering on a buffer of protection so we don't have to feel all that. The highs, the lows, all the intensity.
That's a great answer, and let's get concrete with that. And while you were talking, I was thinking of what our culture did. I have two sons, they're adults. And I've asked them on several occasions, did we screw your life over? We didn't do the Little League thing. We came to Holden. I ran a waterfront at a young life camp for 5 summers. We were all over the place doing these things with the other kids. I heard a woman talking in one of these sessions earlier this week. I wasn't here last week. She said, soccer meets Sunday morning now, and I got to go. I mean, if our kid doesn't go, she doesn't get to play in the next 2 games if we miss. So we go. I'm trying to be concrete with the illustrations. And I'm not patting myself on the back. We didn't do the Little League thing. Hooray, that's noble, huh? I don't know, but that part of the culture we didn't buy.
Choices.
But so what are some of those that we... No, I'm sorry. I know we should be... I don't know about church. Whatever you think about that. We should be in church, or we should be together as a family, but instead I'm going to be a spectator. I'm going to haul my kids off and watch them play instead of playing with them. You get the point. So I'm just asking to be as concrete as we can here with this, what you call, and insightfully so, our cultural pressures. Pilate just turned her back on all of them. Threw away every assumption she had and began at zero. When am I happy and when am I sad? If you have gay friends, it's, coming out of the closet. When am I happy? When am I sad? You turn your back on the culture that's been so oppressive and say, this is who I am. And I'm going to be happy now.
Okay, the concrete thing is we will choose any distraction over quiet. We will turn on the TV at night instead of sitting and journaling.
TV is a big one. You probably know the statistics better than I do. The average kid watching. Yeah.
6 hours. I think there's something new in our culture too, with our cell phones and our laptops and our connections to the email stuff. But I think if you decide to not be hooked into that, or to limit your amount of hook the time you hook in. It's easy for me to say, I've been living at Holden.
Yeah. It's a debate at Holden all the time. It has been for as long as Holden's been in existence, 40 years. Now, what do we do about phones? What do we do about email? And it'll never stop being, a question. Dorothy and Roy, you guys know this, as teaching staff coordinators, you ask teachers to come up here to, give their time and do it free and say, well, can I talk to my kids back home? No. Well, I'm not going to give that up. So the cell phone, I just wrote my sons a letter, and I said, I've forgotten how great it is not to have 20 phone calls a day. and we come to home and get reminded of that, When the phone rings, let it ring.
But I think that also accentuates, kind of the fear of not being connected or the uncomfortable thing.
Yep.
Look for distractions, but we also long for that connectedness, not wanting to be disconnected.
Yep, we got to connect to the culture. We got to be part of it. We got to be the best soccer player, at least be on the team. I think that has something to do with the story of walking on the water, Peter. When he can't give up the connection. Anthony Padovano is a wonderful Catholic theologian in a book called Free to be Faithful. It says that all human beings, all human journeys start on the land but have to go on the water. And where there's no firmness of, the firm assurance of the earth is forsaken. I love that line. You're not connected to the culture.
I was going to say, I think also here, especially like clothes and toiletries and all of that kind of stuff, that there's, I've always felt close to people that I've met at Holden, they're some of my closest friends, because I feel like, if somebody's seen me in my garbo clothes that I stole from Potty Patrol and don't have any makeup on, and you know, like that's totally me, who I am at my absolute worst. And if that person likes hanging out with me, then it's an assurance that that they really know who I am and that that's who they're like.
Yeah.
They're liking.
It's so simple and yet so profound. That's a connection, and that's a stripping away. I don't need this. Good.
I'm not sure it's in the culture's the issue. The older I get, the more I'm convinced that it's what other people think of me. Within every culture, there are things that you do to distract you from who you really are.
Yeah.
And I spend too much of my time trying to have other people approve of me.
Don't we all?
But the other side of it is that I think that for me, Pilate's sort of struggle on the other side of it is mine. I can become very reclusive and say, I don't care what you think about me,
yeah.
And never not be connected with others.
Yeah.
And that's the dance that I find.
Yeah. Nice word. I'll put them up in your way. Connect. Disconnect. And then the dance that goes on in between. How far do we take this? When am I happy? When am I sad? Am I happy just because I've pleased my father? I saw him.
Yeah.
Good.
Well, Pilate reminded me, I have a granddaughter that has no belly button. And this isn't funny. She was born extremely premature and had a lot of surgeries, and in so doing, they removed, as they cut things, they cut her belly button. And just a couple of weeks ago, she lives in California. Her mother called and said, what shall we do? She wants plastic surgery because she, in California, where bare midriffs are
beautiful. You bet. Wow, what a story.
So she said, what shall we do? She wants plastic surgery on her stomach. And of course, she's too little for that. She's 11 years old.
Yeah.
But that's a big deal.
Of course.
Yeah, it is.
That's our centering.
What a great story. What?
That's our centering. You know, you talk about navel gazing or whatever, but. That's our centering.
Yeah. Well, if you ask people, and I know people, some people in the entertainment industry, the pressure on women to have their breasts changed, it's incredible. Beauty contests, models, it's really... And then the dance is, okay, you can disconnect, I don't care, I'm going to do this, but unless you're a Meryl Streep or the greatest act, you know, you better do what they say, you better connect or you won't be working. You better not go to church or you won't be on the soccer team. Keep going. Stuff is just so... I mean, I think it's the reason I teach literature. One of the things that literature does is it raises our consciousness about stuff we never gave a thought to before. I mean, it makes us see... I didn't see that. Literature is about vision. And day to day, what do we do that prevents... You know, what assumptions do we have that we live with? I assume that gay teacher is going to promote her gayness on my child. I don't want her teaching my kid. Where does that assumption come from? Pilate stripped away every assumption she had. So wait, this is really a good teacher. You get the point.
The giving it all away struck me because that's a struggle that I have all the time with my Christianity and how Jesus was. Give it away. You know, just don't hold back. And yet we live in a society where if you don't take care of yourself, you could be impoverished, there won't be any social security, blah, 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 you know.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to look out for your kids, you want to put them through college, and so you have to balance. Again, it's kind of a balance between generosity and care and the problems of the world and taking care of your own backyard, you know,
You most of you are old enough to reach the stage where your kids might tell you, I don't want anything for Christmas. You know, just come and visit me. My kids haven't said that yet. But they're only 25. So. actually, they do. What? I don't need anything. But we
we spent a lot of time, don't we, early on. But yeah, keep going. As much concrete stuff, we've got 1 minute. But you're onto it, and so it's not only stuff, and it's not only cultural, and that you're right. It's not only cultural. It's not in clothes and toiletries. That's right. But what about, we got to put it down, and you just quickly, what about some of the assumptions that we live by? I teach African American literature, and the assumptions that the white world has made for 3 centuries in America, they're incredible. You got to strip away the assumptions and then, you know, okay, that kind of thing. What assumptions have we made?
I think that we can't even see our assumptions.
We can't. It's a great point.
Because, I mean, we worked on, we had a really excellent anti-racism session here at Colden, and just, it took us 2 days to untangle even just how Colden functions.
Yep.
Creates barriers for anybody who does things differently, sees things differently, comes from a different cultural group. We don't even know. I mean, we ring the bell and, you know, we have to do things in certain orders.
Yep.
All of that is, for us, a way of doing it, and for somebody else, a doorway and a barrier. Mm-hmm. And we can't even see it until we give it just the right, have the right guidance.
I'll give us 3 that are really controversial, have been a part of the Lutheran Church for a long time, some of them more subtle than others, but what assumption is it that we say we're not going to have a black pastor? What have we assumed when we say that? What have we assumed when we say, as we did in Tewin, 1975? You know, we're not going to have a female pastor. And we still say we're not going to have a gay pastor. What assumptions are we making when we say that? Or, move on, we're not going to have a... I hear this, and it's just a silly one. We're not going to have a track coach that teaches English. Really, I hear it. English is way too intellectual. I say, talk to me, it ain't intellectual. I'll prove it. Where do they come from? And I love Gail's comment. We have so many assumptions, we don't even know what they are.
Yeah. Well, you stumble across them in life. You know, and the thing you need to have, I think, to do that is you gotta open yourself. You can't just rush through life. You gotta slow down, and when something rubs you wrong or gets you riled up, that's when you gotta stop and listen, because that's the point at which you can learn something. When you start getting all huffed up and pissed off because it's just not right, that's when you better go, uh-oh.
Yeah, that's good.
What am I doing?
Here's Pod's question. When am I happy? When am I sad? Macon was not happy fondling his keys. He was happy when he looked in the window and watched Pilate sing. I needed some music that night. But he does, so he can't get rid of that. This isn't just a statement about hedonism, right? Hey, this makes me happy. When am I happy? When I've had 4 glasses of wine. It isn't that, and we know that. What happiness is, the kind of happiness that's part of the Sermon on the Mount, probably. Blessed are those. You get it. Anybody? Song of Solomon. It's highly recommended. Okay, see ya.
Thank you.